Welcome to the Access Advocacy Podcast. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. I have someone that I'm so excited to be working with, and her name is Francesca Valentine. Many of you know her as Mrs. Valentine and as mom to Marcus and Ashley. Hi, Francesca, or Mrs. Valentine. We have to figure out what we're going to call you.
Oh, just call me Fran. Hi.
Hi, Fran. So we thought that today what we do is kind of, I know all of you know us, but we're going to kind of skip the more traditional kind of this is what I do, that's what I do thing. And we're going to just talk about our journey as mothers with children of sickle cell. So I'm going to start off with how I found out about Marissa. So I grew up in a family. We've all heard the story of my brother Teddy, my mom's fight to keep him alive and healthy for as long as he could. She made sure all of us were tested. I had a FOS negative. I was told that I didn't have trait. And my other elder brother had trait, and the younger brother was an A. He was normal. So I didn't really think about it when looking for a mate for myself because I felt I was safe. And so that's kind of how I went through my life, thinking I was, you know, lucky that I didn't have to think about it. So when Marissa was born and they did newborn screening, I got this letter that said that they thought she had sickle cell. And so our reaction was really, really like, that's not possible, you know. And I ran around, much like I do now, to every expert I could find. We had so many tests done. I just remember sitting there and them coming out and saying, you know, you're going to have to pay for these tests. And I was, you know, yes, of course, whatever. And finally, after weeks and weeks and so many tests, I mean, I had to accept the fact that I had trait, her dad had trait, and that Marissa had sickle cell. And she was pretty healthy in the beginning, so if I had not had that test, we would have gone possibly on for years before we knew what was going on. So, Francesca.
Our scenario is similar in the way that I knew I had the trait, and my husband was told he was negative. And then our oldest was born normal. And then when we were pregnant with Marcus, it was about... he had to get oral surgery. So he was retested prior to anesthesia for the anesthesia workup for the oral surgery. And then I got the call, Mrs. Valentine, are you aware that your husband is 48% hemoglobin S? And I went, oh no, because it was too late. I was already 8 months pregnant, so nothing could be done. Amniocentesis would have been too high of a risk at that time. And we weren't going to do anything about it anyway, so there was no point to take that risk for the amniocentesis. It wasn't until 6 months old, despite my request, that he had his first crisis at 6 months. And then the story just goes downhill from there. But it started the same way with the inadequate testing, being, you know, having these false negatives. And then not honoring my request for testing. I mean, I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that I was such a difficult delivery that that wasn't their top priority at the moment. Don't really know. On and on from there.
Yeah. So it's interesting. My reaction to having had the false negative was... I was just, you know, devastated. I mean, and I felt so guilty that I didn't make them when they, you know, and I was a little kid when we got all the tests, right? But I felt like I should have known, right? I should have known that they could make mistakes. I should have, I don't know, we you know, I remember firing off this letter and saying, you know, you've got to use better tests, and these, your why is this test come out negative? And then I found out that they did a smear and instead of the apheresis, and, you know, I think for me it really was the anger that, and the fear, right? The fear more than anything, that I knew the journey that I was going to have based on what had happened with my brother, and I wanted somebody to pay for it. But then it's like you said, had you known to begin with, would it have made any real difference anyway? I mean, once you're pregnant. Yeah.
Right. And there's nothing we can do. So, I mean, we just had to live with whatever God decided should be our path. And that's just how we accepted it, because there's nothing to do about it. And the healthcare system is remiss with their inadequate testing process, because as we know, sickle cell has been on a 100-year journey for, you know, proper testing. And it's not like ASACs, where you get the premarital testing. Sickle cell doesn't have that, so that you can genetically plan your family safely.
Right.
Sickle cell is not offered that option. It's hit or miss. For me, as a healthcare professional, very distressed.
Yeah, I know my mom used to say to me all the time that, you know, that she would use Tay-Sachs as the model. And she'd always say, well, you know, we can stop it because, and she'd say this, the Jews stopped it. So it's a conversation I kind of have a lot with people, particularly those that aren't that familiar with our disease. And I say to them, well, first it's the numbers, first who it's affecting. And the third thing is that our children with proper treatment survive and thrive, whereas children with Tay-Sachs have this horrible, horrible from birth presentation of the disease. So I just want to, you know, put that bit of nugget out when people are basically told that, right? That we should be able to just stop having kids, you know, if we have sickle cell, or if we have a child with sickle cell, we're somehow bad people because we don't want to end the pregnancy and we bring these children into the world. Our children in this country should be able to have, I would say for someone with a genetic illness, a high quality of life. That our quality of life isn't so necessarily tied to the disease, but tied to the treatment that we receive.
Our disease was hit or miss at best for 100 years.
Yeah.
And because the population is primarily African American, there was no presence or push to really do anything about it. And it wasn't until 2014 when we affected the growth of, you know, the GDP was affected by sickle cell. We had over $3 billion in healthcare expense, primarily ER visits, that eyebrows raised. And we're like, oh, they're costing a lot of money, the powers that be, to do something about this. And first of all, for this type of disease, they should have had adequate testing from the beginning. It should be part of having that option to be tested prior to starting a family. And then for sure, you have to test prior to anesthesia. But then to get a false negative prior to undergoing anesthesia, that's dangerous.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, for us, that my mom, that was her second concern, right? I mean, I had been pretty healthy, but the boys, they were all in athletics, right? And so I had 27 boy cousins, and so many of them had, you know, injuries and things where they were actually put under. And it was always a big deal when one of the cousins who was in AS was going under. I know my mom was like, oh my goodness, you know, when we talked about it in later years. She voiced her real, feeling like she should have known, and what ifs, you know, what if I had to go under, what if I had been broken a leg, what if the kind of what ifs. And I think you're absolutely right about that.
And that speaks to now of knowing your status. Everyone has to know their status to plan, because it's so important. Not just for family planning, health planning. Because even if it's sickle cell trait, there still can be consequences, like prolonged travel at high altitude, for example.
Yes.
If you wanted to climb a mountain, you want to join the military, that rigorous military training. We lost two kids up here at the Naval base here in Illinois during training, and they had sickle cell trait, because you can't tolerate that, the rigors of the high heat and the extreme physical demand. It has to be modified. And then as they do research, I'm sure they'll find that in certain circumstances, sickle cell trait will have its own set of problems. But going back to the family planning, now here we are in almost 2021, there really should be no reason for anyone not to know their status, other than the cost of the testing and maybe not having insurance to know. That should be part of your annual screening. It doesn't get the level of importance that it should, like diabetes screening, hypertension screening, you know, mm-hmm. things like mm-hmm. that. There should be a rapid screening, finger stick, at the very least, minimum part of screening.
Well, we've been talking about it because we're like looking at what happens, right? In areas that don't have newborn screening or do have newborn screening. And we're like, what can we do? Because some parents are told when the child has trait and it doesn't mean anything. And it sort of gets, that information gets lost through the, you know, through moves, through daily conversations. We were looking at why aren't those kind of screenings done at major checkpoints, health checkpoints. So if they're getting ready to go to preschool, if they're starting, they go in for certain vaccinations when they go to middle school, high school, that in those exams that everybody has to have, right, and are mandated, that there is a check, so that if somehow the person doesn't know their status, that then it is confirmed.
Some of that goes back to the discrimination aspect, though, because I think the education on what to do to be checked, but then what to do with the information, because there are concerns for diagnosis. For example, my life insurance was turned down, commercial life insurance was turned down because I have asthma. So as they more and more learn about sickle cell, I could easily see sickle cell trait being used to give somebody a higher insurance premium. So instead of just being used for the benefit of bringing a healthy child into the world, or being safe for your healthcare and anesthesia, I could also see alternative motives for that information. So there needs to be safeguards in place. And our generation, we all know about Tuskegee. And that is not going to leave our brains anytime soon, the Tuskegee experiment. And where they gave the study patients syphilis and did not tell them. Things like this, that is going to always be in the back of people's minds, the older generation for sure, when it comes to research and new things and new treatments and participation. And we have to get beyond that with transparency.
Right.
And then asking the hard questions, like, how do we make sure that knowing the status is for patient safety and benefit, not for retribution?
Right, right. Well, I know with us, I mean, again, being a family that was sort of hyper aware because of my mother's insistence on not hiding my brother away, we as kids could always tell the cousins who had trait. And I didn't have trait, but I was always in that pile. I was always the one who had the flu the longest. I was always the one that caught every single thing. I was the one who was extra clumsy too, where I would get the muscle weakness and drop things. I would get sick if we went up to the snow. You know, all of those sorts of things, as you say, are things we need to be aware of. But the aspect of it being used against us is something that, as we are doing our advocacy work, that we have to be very mindful of to try to put some things in place. And then the question becomes, how do we do that? And in our efforts to get people to make sure they know their status, how do we help them become, I guess, comfortable enough in that? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I know for me, though, when I did get that letter, other than A, being shocked that I didn't know enough about my own body, and B, that now I have this beautiful child who has this debilitating disease, a lot of other things changed. Was suddenly everything I did in my life, all the decisions we made, everything was through that lens of having a child with sickle cell disease. And as she was the first, it was on. So then on top of, what do you do with a new baby? What do you do with a new baby that has sickle cell? And I think the first year, as you're learning all those things, for me, it was, I would be so scared. All the kids would want to come and hug her. You know what I mean? And our family passed baby to baby to baby, and I was just terrified. I had sort of a COVID baby before they had COVID babies. I would cover her little mouth over, you know, and just how things really changed for me. You know, that thing of how I thought our journey was going to be, to what early on I thought it could only be. And then I became aware that I was resisting both of those things and started a plan or a path of what we wanted it to be, right? The life we could make.
Kind of work with what you have and get just kind of at it. You still have to live within whatever it is and make modifications. For me, because I'm a nurse and I'm most of my background critical care, emergency room, this type of thing. I spent most of Marcus's life a lot of times being more critical care nurse for this house than mother. And I think that true grit as critical care nurse is what kept him here to 36 years old. He right out of the gate, very sick. He had every textbook complication except renal failure that you can have from the disease. And many people didn't realize that because we managed every single complication, which then it overtakes everything else in your life. Like relatives would make comments, well, you guys never go anywhere. You never do anything. You're never happy. You're long-winded. You know, I was like the Evil Lynn of the world. I didn't have time for anything else. If I was going to keep him alive and let him try to have a child's life and let our family try to do kids stuff, there were measures that had to be taken so he didn't suffer, like to reduce the suffering and preserve his body organs the best we could, because one day there'll be a cure. Well, you always live in that state of mind. Mm-hmm. And each of your other children have a different perspective on what that's like. Like my oldest one just succumbed to all the pressure. And the youngest one, she thrived with the pressure. So it was terrible for the oldest. and semi, not as terrible for the younger one.
Uh-huh.
But, and speaking of the younger one, I had really, after Marcus, I had asked for a tubal ligation.
Me too.
Yeah, they wouldn't do it. They told me no. Because they said, if your child dies, there may be a chance you want to have another child. And also, I was so sick. I was very mm-hmm. sick. So I could not, they just did not want to keep me, I guess, in the operating room any longer than necessary, whatever. But when, despite all forms of birth control, we got pregnant with my daughter, and the comments were horrendous. Things like, you're a nurse, you should know better. What are you, a sucker for punishment?
Oh,
how could you do this? You know, I mean, just terrible comments. And people tend to do that without walking in a person's shoes.
Yep.
And it was with all the media, social media and stuff like that now, you can have the court of opinions without showing your face or hearing your voice. So, but back then, it was just, these are just direct comments to me. It was pretty bad.
Oh, yes.
And, spent a lot of time getting accused of all kinds of things because I'm an intense person. And it makes you always at a level 10 when your children's life is at stake and your family's well-being. And mm-hmm. I'm talking about everything from the roof over your head to the food on the table.
Yep.
You know, so you live in a world of survival. And that's what the world, we still live. I mean, we could see from Marcus's funeral that let him be a kid as much as we could. And everybody got to be a kid. That was a very important part, was to be a kid. But also knowing that the mortality was at question here, and these days are numbered. So you would make choices that, to get opportunities that wouldn't come, you're not going to have that opportunity again.
Right.
So if you needed to get up and go to the apple orchard because this was a good day, you go do it.
Right.
If you needed to, you know, get this item or something first, sometimes some of these bills would go on the back burner because we needed to make sure that this was done first because we may not have a chance to ever do that again. And I wanted the fewest regrets as possible.
Yep.
So that's a difference. They don't, and by the way, they don't have financial planning for families with chronic disease that doesn't have a schedule. And by that I mean, say for example you have a cancer and your treatment's gonna be 12 weeks of chemo. That gives you some type of a goal to do some management within. Like, people can help you for 12 weeks. Because you can tell them it's 12 weeks.
Right, right.
Or you can say, my chemo appointments are Monday, Wednesday, Friday at this location at this time. Now, the complications that happen from it, you can't always predict, but you know what the complications could be, so you try to prevent. Sickle cell is not that type of disease.
Oh.
Sickle cell drops you whenever, wherever it feels like,
yep.
at any given time.
Yeah.
And how do you... You know, in all the caregiver literature, all the manuals, all the buzzwords, I don't want to hear any more buzzwords because they're just buzzwords. When you have something that's 24/7, 365, and with no warning can drop you in your family, there's not a line around the corner waiting to do this for you and do that. You burn people out.
Yeah.
And you can't expect help.
Yeah.
Because there's no help. 24/7, 365, except yourself.
Yep, I call it with sickle cell, we live with a great disruptor. And people, I mean, for me, my coping mechanism was to just kind of minimize at one point what I told them. I'd have friends, right? I mean, I think I kind of had a double whammy because my brother, who was very much like Marcus. Actually, when I met Marcus, I was my tears swelled up in my eyes because he's so much. I mean, he sounded like Teddy. He moved like Teddy. He looked like Teddy. And I thought, oh my God, here's my you know, my sweet boy back, right? But for me, the whole thing of support and family, I got so judged because I did what you did, and that I wanted Marissa to have a life, and I wanted her to go to school, and I wanted her to do all these things. And my mom's approach, and I mean, hero or shero that she was to keep Teddy at home with us, but, you know, he'd go on outings and things, but he didn't really have a life outside of her. And I was determined that since Marissa's in her lifetime, there was going to be a cure, that she had to be ready to have that life. And so with my family, every time she got sick, they would ask me, well, what did she do? Or what did you do? You know, well, she wouldn't have gotten sick if you hadn't, you know, taken the job, if you had stayed at home with her full time, you know, those kinds of judgments. And the coping mechanisms for that, for me, what I would do is I would just not tell them. I just learned not to ask for help. But I recognized when I had friends who were willing to help, I called them my found family.
Village.
yeah. And so I think the result for me also with getting the letter, other than now health and safety becoming definitely my North Star as to what I should worry about or not worried about, right? Maybe your true family is a found family.
It's your village. It's your village.
It is a village.
Relation. Let me tell you, in this house, my side of the family had no idea what was going on. Like my dad's side, they had no idea. They had no idea. We live in the western suburbs. Most of them live in Chicago, Chicago and south suburbs. They really didn't know what was going on. And his relatives, they didn't really get it. The first time he almost died, I called everybody and said, we don't know if he's going to make it, so you might want to come and see him now. Because if he dies now, I don't want any mess at the funeral. Don't be like, you know, wailing and hooping, oh, my nephew, my cousin. No. Mm-mm. Because you know what? When he fell out in that high chair, we had to call 911, and I had to throw my other kid at a neighbor because we had to go. And we didn't come back for 3 days, and that breakfast was rotten on the stove. Where were you?
Yeah.
What, you know, so don't. Unless you really want to, you know, I had my one relative. Oh, he's not as sick as he is. He's going to be all right. I said, no, he is as sick as he is. And I don't know if he's going to be all right. Then I had to listen to, there was a lot.
Yeah.
So let me see here. What was I? I'm no fun. We didn't go anywhere. They always wanted to have like parties and gatherings at this house. But I couldn't do all that because, first of all, I was working either one or two jobs. I worked night shift. I needed to maintain the health insurance because I knew that public assistance was useless.
Yeah.
And I need to work somewhere where I have a fighting chance of not getting fired if I had to call an ambulance again,
yep,
and get him, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm,
this was
mm-hmm.
like every few weeks. So they used to do stuff like he was the sick kid now. So they give him a gift and not my other one who was 3 years older. So finally I put a stop to that.
Yep.
I told my husband, I said, tell your relatives that he doesn't get a whole pie because he's skinny. He doesn't just get a gift. I said, I'm sick of unwrapping them, splitting the gift in two. So if it was a shirt and pants, I'd open it and I rewrap it into two boxes. So they each got something. I said, if this happens again, the unwrapped gift goes in the Goodwill box. Nobody gets anything. Because disease or no disease, they're all children. And he is not going to survive this disease unless we bring him up tough as nails. Because I said, there's going to be people who aren't going to give a damn about sickle cell.
That's right.
And he's still going to have to make it in this.
Going to have to make it in this world.
And be able to speak up and be able to know when he needs help. I said, we will do him no favors. And we cannot punish the other kids who don't have sickle cell.
Right.
You know, the sickle siblings can easily be neglected. My oldest one wanted to kill himself at 5 years old. He asked me, will you love me better?
Oh, no.
When I get sickle cell.
Oh.
And he wanted to die, too.
Well, you know, I think it's really good that you and I have found each other and we're doing this, because I am finding, when I look back in retrospect, when I spend time with other sickle cell moms, generally we're just problem solving, right? I get a call, my kid's here, my kid needs help. What do I do? But to just sit down and share our experience and talk about this, and I think will help not only us, moms of older children, but also for those new moms, so that those new moms can see and be supported in ways that we weren't.
We were not.
So.
And, you know, being judged is unacceptable. And because the thing is, you have to wear so many hats.
So.
But I mean, so there is no financial planning for severe, chronically ill parents of children. I will say this to anyone that's listening. If you have the opportunity to absolutely secure the roof over your head, whether like we got the advice not to pay off our house when we were able, that we should do this, this, and this. That was the worst possible advice we could have ever taken in our financial lives. We should have paid off our house, because you have to have a home base somewhere to get them to all their medical treatments,
I think now we've hit on now our next topic. So we've talked about when we got the diagnosis and sort of how that affected us. I think for our next talk, we should maybe talk about how getting that notice, what are the things we should have, you and I have both learned, should put into place from that point on, kind of like if we knew then what we know now.
Hindsight.
I like
it. Next one will talk about hindsight.
But I think so, and in lots of different places. So I know the financial part is very important. So on our next talk, let's pick it up from there, and we'll talk about some of the financial decisions and supports and hindsight. Does that sound good?
That sounds like a great
one. Okay, I think this is going to be fun. So we want to thank everyone for joining us, and Francesca and I look forward to you joining us on our next talk.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. But before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's axisadvocacy.org. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.